On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New Yorker writer Jeffrey Goldberg grew up taunted by history and anti-Semitism, an American Jew eager to lift a rifle for Israel. He joined the Israeli army in the First Intifada and was assigned to help guard a prison holding Palestinian leaders of that uprising. The cruelties he saw there offended his American sense of right and wrong and quickly challenged his naive idealism. But his effort to reach out and befriend one Palestinian prisoner took him even deeper into the psychological thicket of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now Jeffrey Goldberg is telling his story up next on Point. Jeffrey Goldberg goes deep in the Mideast divide, and we'll hear from author David Mamet on his new book, The Wicked Son. Joining me right now from Washington is Jeffrey Goldberg. He's Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, reported for 10 years from the Middle East for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. His new book is called Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide. Jeffrey Goldberg, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What took you to Israel as a member of the Israeli army in the first place?
Well, a number of things, including but not limited to an early experience with schoolyard anti-Semitism, let's call it, which created in me at a very early age the feeling that a feeling of powerlessness. And when I searched around for an answer to my feeling of powerlessness as a young Jewish kid,
where was that, Jeffrey? Where were you growing up?
And what was the South Shore. I grew up in the one corner of Long Island that was bereft of Jews, on the South Shore of Long Island, mm-hmm. in New York.
It was that bad it left you scarred and searching for, I don't know, for the uniform?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed, my parents took me to Israel when I was 13 for my bar mitzvah, and I saw their Jews carrying guns and Jewish tanks and Jewish armored personnel carriers, and that had quite an impression on me because I was used to... Look, I don't want to make too much of childhood scars here, but on the other hand, they were scars. They were real. And I found an answer to my problem by looking at these soldiers who I knew were Jewish but seemed very un-Jewish to me, if you know what I mean.
We want to hear it. This was on Long Island, anti-Semitism at the kind of what, street, schoolyard level?
Yeah, you know, schoolyard level.
Mm-hmm. Ben the Jew was a game you described your classmates
playing. Yeah, that's a lovely
there.
Game. There are many variations of the pitching pennies game. There's this notion that you can make a Jew bend down by simply throwing a penny at him. And so it was, this particular thing was called Ben the Jew. And I mean, it sounds horrible, and it was when you're 11 or 12 years old to have people throw pennies at you, and then jump you. If you pick the penny up, they jump you, and if you don't pick the penny up, I mean, I never picked the penny up, obviously.
Right.
They jump you anyway.
But the game was there, and the history, the Holocaust, and all the rest was there. And out of that, on your trip to Israel for your bar mitzvah, you saw guys and probably gals in Israel as well in uniform looking tanned and tough and armed, and it looked good
and
to
very un-diaspora like very un-Jew. What I mean by un-Jewish is, of course, they're Jewish, they're another expression of Jewishness, but they are not the image that, or the self-image that you grow up with in the American Jewish community. We have doctors and lawyers and accountants and podiatrists and teachers and scientists, but we don't have that great experience with tough guys.
It made
and so here was a bunch of tough Jews.
Mm-hmm. And it made such an impression that you went. You joined. When did you join? How were you assigned?
It took obviously many years after that. But I always had this in mind that I would do this. And I moved to Israel right after college, 1987. I had two very specific goals. I didn't have just the army as a goal. Mm-hmm. I had joined... partially in response to all of this, a socialist Zionist youth movement, believe it or not, mm-hmm. there is such a thing, mm-hmm. in New York as a teenager, which was meant to instill in us the values of democratic socialism and of the kibbutz. So I decided that I also wanted to be a farmer. I wanted to be the classic Zionist, the farmer soldier. So I lived for a couple of years first on a kibbutz. I was a chicken farmer. Mm-hmm. I was quite a good chicken farmer, in fact.
All right.
Although I eventually became tired of it, and this was a sort of a shock to me, that the reality of chicken farming was not quite the romance of chicken farming.
I got tired of chicken farming a long time ago.
Nobody told me about the smell,
right.
By the way.
Right.
We don't have chicken coops on the South Shore of Long Island.
But it's one thing to be on a kibbutz and another to put on the uniform. Did you know when you arrived in Israel you would do that? Were you drawn on in by the... And remind us of the times. This was...
Well, this is interesting. Look, one of the formative experiences in my life was the raid on Entebbe. This happened when I was 11. My feelings about it weren't coed at the time, but I knew that this was a great moment in Jewish history. And that really motivated me to want to join the Israeli army. Of course, by
Jewish
the time
special
I got
forces,
there...
Flying into Africa, freeing the prisoners and all the rest. Yeah,
it was an incredible moment. It was not just it was a poetic response to the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. It was everything to me. Mm-hmm. But you know, by the time I got to Israel, the raid on Entebbe had been successfully executed. Mm-hmm. And what they needed at the time, what the Israeli army needed at the time, and this is about 1990, what the Israeli army needed was basically policemen, because this was during the height of the Palestinian uprising, the first Palestinian uprising, the Intifada, and so I was sent to a prison camp to be a military policeman. The prison camp was called Ketziot. It was deep in the Negev Desert by the Egyptian border, and it was completely outside my frame of reference. The day I arrived, the prison count was I think 6,200 Palestinians. And you have to remember that I basically never met a Palestinian until this day.
So here you are in uniform, literally as a guard. I mean, marching people around the.
No. Mm-hmm. No, I got a lucky break in a kind of sense, in that I wasn't a guard in a guard tower with a machine gun. Mm-hmm. My title was prisoner counselor. That's the way it translates, at least. It mm-hmm. makes it sound like I was advising them on how to write college essays or something. But it put me in close proximity with the prisoners. I was in charge of making sure that they got their food and their medical needs were taken care of, and I was supposed to try to figure out ways to keep a lid on the place and stop them from rioting. And I was very, very close in with the prisoners, which I was in quite a depression when I got there, because this is not what I wanted to be when I grew up, right? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I saw this as a great opportunity to actually. I realized this almost immediately, that these people, that the prisoners in this camp, were going to one day be the leaders of Palestine. And I thought, at least I should take advantage of this and try to get to know these people.
On the way to that mission, and we'll talk about it, you write about how your sort of pastoral kibbutz dream began to fall apart in the prison, how the interaction of Israeli soldiers and Palestinian prisoners challenge some of your American preconceptions, ideas of right and wrong and justice. Give us a sense for that learning curve.
Well, it's very interesting. I'm glad you picked up on that in the book. I sort of discovered my Americanness in this prison. And by Americanness, I mean a very specific thing. I'll tell you very quickly the story. We used as a means of population control, as a means of keeping people in line, isolation tanks, or they're not isolation, because you would put three or four prisoners into these small, you know, almost telephone booth sized boxes for 24, 48 hours. I hated that. I would try never to do that because I felt it was cruel and unnecessary. One day there was an incident in the prison. A rock was thrown and hit a guard, and my commander came over and demanded that I take the rock thrower and put him into isolation. I said, of course, that I didn't know who the rock thrower was. There were thousands. We had 1,500 prisoners just in our block. Mm. And he said, I don't care. Just take any prisoner. And at that moment, a thought flashed through my mind, and the thought was, well, that's a very un-American idea. You can't just punish someone for something that someone else has done. And so I realized that I was bringing my Americanness to the Middle East in a way. Collective punishment is not an idea that we're raised to believe is a good idea, but in the Middle East it's another thing. And so we had a huge argument about whether or not I could take an innocent man and throw him into isolation. I refused to do it on the grounds that, well, now I realize that I refused to do it because I don't think I could have lived with myself if I had done it. But that was a very interesting moment for me when I realized that I'm a foreigner here in a kind of way.
I want to get a sense of the sort of fullness of your time in Israel and your view there. You worked as a Israeli army prison staff. You've also been in Gaza and the West Bank, seen tough stuff there as a journalist and picked up on. There's a reading from page 256, a kind of moment where you're watching this conflict unfold at very close hand. I wonder if you'd set that up and read it for us, Jeffrey Goldberg. Give us a sense of what you were, where you were here, what you were about to see.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, this is at the beginning of the second uprising when I was back in Israel as a correspondent for The New Yorker. I mentioned before that I left Israel soon after the army service. I could not stay away, of course, but I came back in a different capacity as more of an observer and less a participant. This particular scene took place at the Ayosh Junction, which is in the north of Ramallah, which is the de facto Palestinian capital, which is itself north of Jerusalem. It was during a riot, and there were Palestinian kids and adults facing down some Israeli army jeeps. Why don't I just read this quick to you? Four Israeli jeeps were parked in a tight line about 40 yards from the bus across a stony field. The soldiers inside wore helmets and flak jackets and stepped out to fire tear gas. The Palestinians threw rocks at the jeeps, but they were new to this, and their aim was poor. After dark, the Tanzim, the Fatah militia under Barghouti's command — Barghouti is, by the way, Marwan Barghouti, who was the leader of the uprising in the West Bank — would bring out the guns, but during daylight, this was the province of children. I drank my Coke and watched. It seemed tamed, even languid, not serious at all, until the boy next to me was shot. A geyser of blood erupted sideways out of his neck. He was 16 at most. He collapsed fast. Medics rushed to grab him. They threw him on a stretcher and ran. I was stunned. There was no need to shoot the boy. The Israelis were safe in their jeeps. "You see what they do?" Barghouti screamed at me. I was running up the street, looking for a taxi to take me to the Israeli line. I found one, which took me in a wide loop around the junction to the Israeli side, and within 5 minutes we were behind the Israelis. What a strange and terrible war. I walked with upturned palms to the jeeps. I found a sergeant smoking behind a low wall. I let out a booming shalom. He nodded in return. I asked him in Hebrew why his men were shooting down Palestinians. "They have guns," he said. "No, they don't," I said. "They have stones." "No, they have guns," he said. "That's bull," I said. "I was just there. They don't have guns." "They will," he said, as his comrades continued shooting into the mass of unarmed Arabs.
Jeffrey Goldberg, reading from his book Prisoners. So there's more of the tough stuff. At the same time, all the way from your time at the prison and right up until very, very recently, even now, you were looking for a relationship with the Palestinians, a Palestinian, one in particular, Rafik Hijazi, that you met in the prison. How did you meet him? What did you first make of him?
Well, you know, I was looking for friendship in this prison. I was looking for a way across this divide, and I liked him because he was a young guy, 19, so from a very tough refugee camp in Gaza. But he had a couple of things that set him apart. He didn't seem like a very violent guy. I don't know. You just get an impression of someone, and he didn't seem like one of the real hard men of the Intifada. He also had a sense of humor, which was shockingly lacking on both sides of the barbed wire. And he had a little bit of a sense of detachment from the from the place. He recognized the absurdity of our general situation, as did I, and so we had a not only a joking relationship across the barbed wire, but we talked about very serious things, about culture and politics, and we even talked about religion. And we had a lot of time to talk, because when there wasn't a riot going on, there was very little to do in our enormous prison. So we developed this kind of friendship, almost.
You were lonely. You wanted company. But you really describe wanting more than that in this relationship. What were you looking for at bottom as you reached out to Rafik Hijazi?
Well, I wasn't. I don't know if I was. I was so much lonely as I was curious. I was looking for two things. One was knowledge. I mean, I was a I don't know what you would call it, an aspirational reporter, I guess, at the time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, here's a guy, here's a guy who's interesting. He's going to tell me something I don't know. I was looking for something more than that, though, which was proof that this reality, the reality of our prison, didn't have to be the reality for all time. And I brought to this these conversations I had with him and others another very American idea, which is that disagreement is the byproduct of confusion, and that when you know someone and when you get to know them better, the disagreement dissipates under the light of understanding. And I wouldn't have phrased it that way at the time, but that's what I think I was going into this with, kind of assumptions that, and it sounds a little juvenile and grandiose now to me, but at the time I really did think that in this remote corner of the Israeli-Arab conflict, that maybe I could, in a very, very small way, bridge some kind of gap, even with just one or two people, that might make it less likely that they will want to kill not only me, but others of my people, and that if you can multiply that out, that would actually have some good effect on the overall conflict.
You describe this at some point in the book as, I think, what you called American solutionism, the kind of another American presumption that there's a solution. If only we can get rid of the confusion, the disagreement can dissipate.
Right.
Describe for us this relationship that went beyond after the prison relationship with Mr.
Right.
Hijazi, and your effort to turn it into a real friendship over time and in any number of different locations.
Well, it's the last day of my term in prison. I went around to some of the prisoners that I liked or that I had these relationships with, and I still have it. I still have this little red address book that I went to them and I said, "Give me your address, because one day I'm going to come and look you up in Gaza in the West Bank." And they, of course, laughed because it sounded ridiculous. I didn't know anything. I remember asking one of the guys, "Do you guys have zip codes?" I mean, I didn't even know how to write to them. And they thought it was ridiculous, and I, of course, thought it was sort of ridiculous, too. This was just after the Gulf War. There was no communication, really, at all between the two sides. But 8 years later, in a very different period in Middle East history, during the Oslo peace process, I was already there reporting, and I decided that I was going to go look these guys up. And I did. Rafiq was the first one, in fact, that I found. To make a long story short, he and the others were very, very receptive. I mean, I walked into his – I mean, I'll just to give you a sense of where my head was at, when I went that day to Gaza to look for Rafiq, I brought a gun with me. At the border crossing between Gaza and Israel, I decided to leave the gun in the trunk for two reasons. One was that I really felt like I have to go into this with a level of trust that I do believe in solutionism, I guess you would call it.
Were you going in as a reporter or as a private citizen?
No, right? I was going in naked. I had gone to Gaza before as a reporter, but you had that little invisible force field around you, at least you used to have it, that said,
press.
A neutral observer. Mm-hmm. Now I was going in to announce myself as a former prison guard and telling people that I'm looking for people I used to keep in jail. So I was nervous about it. I mean, the other reason I didn't bring the gun, obviously, was because I'm fairly good shot, but there was no way I was going to shoot my way out of Gaza if things went bad.
You found a welcoming Rafiq, but also a man who was very serious about his religion and the Palestinian cause.
Yeah, well, this is one. I mean, there are many surprises. You don't really know these people in prison that well. And over time, and of course, one of the twists in this book is that Rafiq had in the interim become a graduate student in America, and so we reestablished this relationship over there. But then we continued it. We only lived a mile apart for a couple of years here in Washington. Mm. And we continued it. And what happened in Washington, again, to not go into it in great depth, but what happened was he became more serious about his religion and in ways that I found very disconcerting. I was spending a lot of my time in the late 90s, to after 9/11, obviously, reporting on Islamic fundamentalism and this wave that was taking place, and he joined this in many ways, and so the person I thought was very conciliatory in prison was not the person I I came to know again. And you know, much of the book is a quarrel, is an argument where we're going at it, and you know, it's the opposite of the usual sort of pattern of interfaith dialogue where you paper over differences. I mean, much of our relationship has been arguing about even things that you can't argue about, like theology. But we kept at it, and we have a relationship to this day. I mean, he's very different than I am, but I feel like we know each other, and we also, I think I speak for him on this one. I'm not sure. You're never sure, but I think that we are, in a way, friends.
Jeffrey Goldberg is Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. His new book is called Prisoners. Ethan Bronner in The New York Times over the weekend. Lots of very strong praise for the book and for your work over the years, but at the same time writes that you come across throughout the book as having a rare talent for self-delusion. You've been very upfront about sort of confronting what's idealism and what's delusion, even been in the midst of an ongoing conversation with an Israeli reporter based in the U.S., Shmuel Rosner, who is chief U.S. correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, based in Washington. You and he have been having this dialogue most recently on the Haaretz website about friendship between Israelis, Jews, and Palestinians, yeah. Whether it's possible, how much is possible. Jeffrey Goldberg, Shmuel Rosner joins us right now from Louisville, Kentucky. I want to invite him in. Mr. Rosner, thanks for being here.
Hello from Kentucky.
Hello in Kentucky. Here you are. You've been carrying on this public conversation with a Jew from another country, Jeffrey Goldberg, from the U.S., about the conflict, about friendship between Jews and Israelis and Palestinians. Who's persuaded whom here, Shmuel? Do you believe at this point, has Jeffrey done it? Has he crossed the divide? Can an American Jew do it in a way that's different from an Israeli? Can it really be done?
Well, first of all, of course, I believe Jeffrey that he has a wonderful friendship. Whether this has any implications on the broader issue of the Middle East conflict, I'm not so sure. As I mentioned when I wrote to Jeffrey in our first dialogue in Slate, it's different to have such friendship when you're an American Jew living in Washington, and when your Palestinian counterpart no longer lives in the occupied territories, in the Gaza Strip. It's probably much easier to maintain such friendship in such circumstances than it is to maintain it under the regular circumstances of Israelis and Palestinians living in Israel and in the occupied territories.
And Shmuel Rosner, when you read in Jeffrey Goldberg's book Prisoners about his dismay at the treatment of Palestinian prisoners in the prison camp where he worked in the Israeli army, at the, you know, rough treatment in occupied territories, as an Israeli, how do you respond to this American Jew's shock?
Well, first of all, I understand the shock, and I must say that I'm sure that it's in some or even many instances living in an Israeli prison as a Palestinian prisoner is not a nice and a comfortable experience for the prisoners. I'm also sure that some Israeli soldiers or policemen treated Palestinian prisoners in a way that is undignified and unacceptable. I served myself for a short period of time in such prison, and I can say I was always happy with the way with which Israel treats its Palestinian prisoners. But we do have to remember that this is an ongoing conflict between two people, and when you have prisoners from one side and policemen from the other side, expecting them to be understanding and even friendly, I think is naive. Policemen and soldiers come from all branches of society. Some of them are smarter and some of them are not. Some of them are more human and some of them are not. And the rules under which the Israeli soldiers are operating are very clear, And then it is the obligation of the military, of course, to make sure that these rules are followed by the soldiers. And obviously, it's not always going in the right way.
Let me take a call from Belmont, Massachusetts. Edward is on the line. Hi, Edward, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
First, Jeffrey, I read your book, finished it about 2 weeks ago, and actually read it at the same time I read another book called Scars of War, Wounds of Peace by Shlomo Ben-Ami, and I think they go together. I had an experience similar to yours in the early 80s when I went to Israel for the first time, being an American Jew. My question, I think you're a courageous person from having read the book, and you're not a saint. You've made mistakes observing the situation. So I'll ask a simple pair of questions. One is, it's unclear to me at the end of the book whether your friend Rafik has transitioned somehow from a secular, though still Muslim, view of Palestinian existence to one that's harder in the sense of less forgiving and more aligned with Hamas. And the second question is, if you have a reaction, and also, I forget your friends,
Shmuel Rosner.
Yes,
Shmuel.
His reaction to the editorial in the New York Times yesterday, essentially fairly formally proposing the Hudna from the point of view of Hamas. And I want to put it in the context of other kinds of propositions that have had surprising results. I had a personal connection with the zero option that Ronald Reagan put forward with the Soviets in the 80s. It's not the issue here. But I'm just wondering whether Israel could respond to the proposition of the Hudna in a way that might be more, how shall I put it, surprising and open, and essentially challenge Hamas to come forward with something.
Yeah, to the idea of a Hudna or ceasefire.
Hudna is a ceasefire,
it's,
right.
A long-term truce that essentially creates an opportunity for dialogue between many more individuals. Mm. My point is basically that there are personal stories like yours and your friend Rafik's and many others, both within and without Israel, and I've seen a few myself. And then there's a historical line that Ben-Ami presents that's more about leaders and, idioms, ideologies and idealism. And frankly, I found the end of your book very depressing in a way, because the suggestion is basically that all our good intentions, and I share many of your own, some of which might be naive, are running into a brick wall, and frankly,
right. On the Palestinian side, Edward, thank you for all that. It's right at the heart of the matter. Jeffrey Goldberg, I guess, first to Rafik himself and his evolution.
People have to read it for themselves, but I didn't find the ending of the book quite as depressing as that. He actually is not a Hamas person. He moderates himself in many ways. And he is still, in my mind at least, still looking for the compromise with Israel that a lot of Palestinians are still, even at this late stage, looking for. On the Hamas question, I mean, I'll turn that over to Shmuel. Why not, right? Hamas is basically proposing that they enter negotiations on a long-term ceasefire. Mm. Hamas is a split organization. I don't necessarily believe that the people in Gaza who are asking for this have the power right now. The power rests with Hamas leaders in Damascus who are controlled by Iran, and obviously the Iranians don't want this conversation to be taking place. But Shmuel knows more about it than I do, maybe.
Shmuel, what about first on the front of Rafik Hijazi and his evolution? Do you know him? Have you followed it? Is this now a Hamas member or an Islamic radical?
Well, I don't know Rafik personally, so it's hard for me to testify in regard to this issue. But I did like the reader, the caller. Mm-hmm. I also found the book not just the ending, but many of the details in the book. I did find somewhat depressing, as it presents in a very clear way the hardships that Israelis and Arabs will probably have to overcome in order to achieve peace in the future. It is not just a simple political question of whether Israel will withdraw from such and such percent of the occupied territories. It's not just a matter of walls and borders and security agreements. It's much more profound conflict, and I think the book presents it in a very clear and sobering way. Now, on the question of Hudna with Hamas, since I got a tougher job here and I have to answer, I don't think this question is really on the table right now. There is no serious offer for Hudna right now that Israel can deal with, and I'm sure that if there is such an offer, it will be considered. Now, what we also have to remember that such an offer is not only a question of Israeli and Palestinian matters. It is also an internal Palestinian issue, because if Israel negotiates with Hamas, this will undermine the presidency of Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, who is the more moderate leader of the Palestinians. And there are many considerations here. Israel and the rest of the international community would not want to weaken Abu Mazen in order to achieve truth with Hamas. Mm. So there are many things here to consider. And as soon as there is a serious offer by the Palestinian government, I'm sure it will be debated and negotiated. But
don't hold your
right
breath.
Now,
it sounds as though
really
you're saying
it's premature to talk about it.
I want to try and get another call here from Wayland, Massachusetts. Paul is on the line. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Thank you. I grew up in a strange way that my mother is an Israeli, and her relatives slowly educated me in the fact that Israel is a Middle Eastern country, and it with the veneer of being a Western democracy. And that came as a great shock. And the only Palestinian that I've made contact with is here in the States. He was born in Haifa, and he actually has the only real solution I've ever heard, not that it'll work, but he says, see how wonderfully we get along here. The answer is to move everyone over here and turn that into a museum like it should be.
All of Israel, unlikely, but we understand the frustration. Jeffrey Goldberg, what about it? At the end of the day, I mean, callers raise the question of personal interactions versus history, ideology,
right.
Religion. What's your conclusion?
I guess you could take the Dakotas and give one to the Palestinians and one to the Israelis.
Maybe we
but
should
of course
separate.
They'd fight about which Dakota to get. I'm not hopeless like that. Maybe I'm captive to this American religion of solutionism, that every problem comes with a solution. You just have to keep looking for it. But I don't think it's too late to divide that land into two states. No one will be perfectly happy with what they end up with, but people will be alive to enjoy their lives.
And when Rafiq Hijazi at the end of the book says to you personally, I don't want you to die, I want you to live, do you believe that that extends to Israel itself, or is that just personal?
That's personal, but I don't think it's irrelevant. I think that feeling multiplied can lead to something on the political level. I don't want to overvalue personal sentiment, but I also don't want to undervalue it. I think human connections here are not irrelevant to the larger cause of building an equitable peace.
Shmuel Rosner, a last thought on Jeffrey Goldberg's long journey and his understanding of Israel and this conflict. You said you go away a bit depressed by it. Is there some light here you can point to?
Well, I'm not sure. I'll tell you a short story. Just the other day, a friend of mine, an Arab journalist, I'm not going even to mention the country from which he's coming, because it's a country which has no official connection.
Very quickly, my friend, our time is running out. Yes.
Yeah, well, he called me after reading my dialogue with Jeffrey, and he was saying, well, are we going to see each other again after you go back to Israel? And I said, well, I'm not sure. So, you know, I don't want to lose hope, and I think that Jeffrey is right to be hopeful.
Hope, but no certainty. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Shmuel Rosner with Haaretz, thank you for being with us. And Jeffrey Goldberg, author of Prisoners, thank you for being with us this hour.